According to NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's National Centers for Environmental Information, in 2020 alone, the U.S. experienced $22 billion weather and climate-related disasters. A weather or climate event doesn't have to produce $1 billion in damage to have a story, so I've decided to tell a few of my personal storm and disaster stories. And along the way, I've recruited friends and family to share their stories. And now I'm recruiting you, the listener, to share your stories. Welcome to Caught in the Fury. All right, first up today, we've got some housekeeping, and I want to go ahead and get my content warning out of the way. This storm did produce fatalities, including two small children. I will give a heads up before I get into that in the main episode so that you can either skip ahead or you can choose to skip the episode altogether, and we'll catch you next time. If you want to learn more about storm chasing in the meantime, I highly recommend you catch Chaser Chat with Gabriel Harbor and Dr. Jeff Frame. I'll link them in the show notes. And just as an aside, we have a new first assistant for the podcast. His name is Jim. Jim is a grumpy cat that I adopted from the Humane Society yesterday. So if you can hear him purring in the background, just know that he's our new weather intern. I do want to give a little bit of a rundown as part of my housekeeping of just the Fujita scale, so you guys kind of have an idea of what's going on as far as when I'm talking about F2, F3, it gives you kind of an idea of what's going on the ground with those. And I also want to give a quick timeline of the storm before we really jump into the main episode. So with that being said, I'm going to go ahead and start off with the Fujita scale. For this episode, when I say, you know, F2, F3, F5, the Fujita scale was modified in 2007, and now we use the enhanced Fujita scale. And all that does is it kind of uses some different, more precise metrics to measure damage and what's going on the ground to kind of rate those tornadoes. So since this storm happened in 1991, I did locate a rundown of the original Fujita scale, which I will be going by for this episode. And we're going to start out with F0, and the wind speeds in that are anything less than 73 miles an hour. The wind speeds are pretty much an estimate, so it's not like a hard or fast rule of, well, they must be. It's just kind of an estimate based on the damage that's produced. So an F0 with winds less than 73 miles an hour, this is going to produce light damage. So chimneys might be knocked over, tree branches are broken, trees with shallow root systems are pushed over, signboards like what you'd see on the side of the road would be damaged. An F1 between 73 and 112 miles an hour results in moderate damage. So this is going to peel the surface off your roof. It's going to take some shingles. It might take some of the like decking underneath it. It's going to blow some cars off the road. Mobile homes are going to get pushed off of their foundations or be like completely overturned. And that's just an F1. So keep that in mind as we get into the rest of this episode, because by the time this storm hits Andover and impacts a mobile home park, it will be at the top of the scale at an F5. So just kind of for reference, an F1 will knock a mobile home off its foundation. An F2 between 113 and 157 miles an hour, that creates considerable damage. So roofs are going to be torn off of frame houses, mobile homes are outright demolished, large trees can be snapped or uprooted, light object missiles are generated, cars are lifted off the ground, and box cars are overturned. Now, I did kind of look into about what a box car weighs, and Union Pacific was kind enough to provide me with a gross weight of about 270,000 pounds, which is roughly 100 tons. And your average car is only 1.5 tons. So You can kind of see where we're starting to head at this point. In an F3, winds are between 158 and 206 miles an hour. Now we start seeing severe damage, like roofs and walls are torn off of well-constructed houses, trains are overturned, and if you live in an area with a lot of trees, most of the trees in that area will be uprooted. Heavy cars are lifted and thrown in this category. In an F4, from 207 to 260 miles an hour, give or take, we see devastating damage. And this is well-constructed homes are leveled. Structures with weak foundations are blown some distance from that foundation. Cars are thrown and large missiles are generated. In an F5 at the top of the category, winds are between 261 and 318 miles an hour, and this produces incredible damage. So this is strong framed houses are being leveled from their foundations and completely swept away. Automobile-sized missiles are going to fly through the air, you know, in excess of 100 yards. Trees are debarked and incredible phenomena occur. And I didn't really have a chance to look up exactly what they were defining as incredible phenomena, but I'm going to go with it's probably where you see in pictures of like playing cards being driven into the siding of a house or a piece of straw being driven through a telephone pole. I mean, it's stuff that you just don't see unless something incredible is happening. I mean, no, I'm not trying to be facetious, but it's, you know, there's a reason that that category exists, and there's a reason that they consider that damage incredible. A timeline of this storm, I'm going to cover a timeline just for the storm that hit Andover. And in the main episode, I'm going to go back and I'm going to hit a couple of other notable tornadoes from that particular system. But the timeline for the Andover storm, it really starts the day before. So April 25th, the National Severe Storms Forecast Center, which is now the Storm Prediction Center, releases a high-risk forecast for the following day, for the 26th. And on 4/26, on April 26th, about 5:15, the supercell that would go on to produce the Haysville-Andover tornado drops its first tornado about 60 miles southwest of Andover near Anthony, Kansas. At 5:49, the storm produces a tornado east of Clearwater, Kansas, which is about 25 miles southwest of Andover. This is the tornado that would grow into the F5 that would impact Andover and some of the communities nearby. At 6:20, Haysville, which is 15 miles southwest of Andover, is struck with damage but no fatalities. And it's at this point that the tornado crosses I-35 and starts to head for McConnell Air Force Base. At 6:24, McConnell Air Force Base takes a direct hit and several buildings are damaged or destroyed. They have some injuries, but no fatalities. At 6:30, the tornado warning is issued for Butler County, which includes Andover. Andover's sirens fail, and they rely on emergency services to go out and warn the community of this impending storm. And somewhere in the 6:30 to about 6:35 time frame, law enforcement starts making their way through the Golden Spur Mobile Home Park, warning residents of the approaching tornado. At 6:45, the tornado slams into Andover and the Mobile Home Park, and it leaves incredible damage and 13 fatalities. At 7:10, the tornado finally dissipates west of El Dorado and north of the Kansas Turnpike, about 46 miles after it first touched down. So, you know, there's some times in here that I found interesting going back and looking at it, because I know what warning time is like now versus what it used to be like, and I didn't realize that there was almost 15 minutes of warning before the storm hit Andover. So, it's just kind of an interesting thing for me to note going back and looking at it, because I was so young when it happened. It's going back and refreshing myself on the things that I maybe was too young to understand or too young to really even pick up on when it was going on. But now that I've given you kind of a little bit of a rundown of the Fujita scale, so you kind of have an idea in your mind of what's going on the ground, and we have a timeline, I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to take a minute and we're going to hop into the rest of the episode. In an era of instant communication, stories about the weather circle the globe in hours. Major floods, hurricanes, tornadoes, and wildfires are photographed and videoed from every imaginable angle and transmitted around the world with the push of a button. In this episode, I take us back 30 years to 19 hours at the end of April that greatly influenced my interest in severe weather. April 26, 1991 is just one of the events in my memory that led me to start this podcast. This outbreak was one of the most significant weather events of the 1990s, and probably of the modern era. In recent years, it has been overshadowed by events like Moore in 1999, Joplin and Tuscaloosa in 2011, and El Reno and Moore again in 2013. The uniqueness of Hayesville and Andover in 1991 doesn't lie in its destruction, though significant, nor in its fatalities, who are still loved and missed, but in the era of its occurrence. Home video cameras were rising in popularity, they were easily obtained and relatively easy to operate. What they captured that day remained indelibly etched into my memory and into the memory of many Kansans and weather enthusiasts alike. Another unique item of note about this event is that April 26, 1991 was only the second time ever that the National Weather Service had issued a tornado watch using the particularly dangerous situation wording. Its first use was back in April of 1982 for the April 2nd tornado outbreak. The 2011 super outbreak, which saw tornadoes in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, produced 11 EF4s and 4 EF5s, is just kind of a modern example of the particularly dangerous situation watch and kind of what can happen on a day that that type of watch is issued. Meteorologists at Wichita's local TV news stations all seemed to be in agreement by Monday, April 22nd, that a risk of very severe weather was possible on Friday. Mike Smith, then chief meteorologist for KSNW, Wichita's NBC affiliate, recalled communicating this days in advance, breaking a taboo of broadcast meteorologists talking about tornadoes more than 24 hours in advance of the event. Also worth noting, the Doppler radar that we know today was just a prototype. Only one functioning unit was online in Norman, Oklahoma as a test. That unit was brought online on April 22, 1991, the same day meteorologists in Wichita were beginning to realize the risk of severe weather for that Friday. In the days after the outbreak, the value of the NEXRAD system of Doppler radars was really brought into focus by the data collected from the Norman, Oklahoma unit, and offices across the country clamored to get this system in place. In 1991, broadcasters such as KSNW and KFDI, a Wichita area radio station, relied on radar and a fleet of storm spotters to track weather and warn the public. This system, in addition to information from the National Weather Service office in Wichita, helped alert viewers and listeners to danger in the area. While the Hayesville-Andover storm produced remarkably little lightning, what little it did caused havoc on the ground. A bolt of lightning struck the system that news agencies used to receive information like warnings from the National Weather Service. Meteorologists like Chief Meteorologist Mike Smith at KSNW and Meteorologist Merrill Teller at KWCH, which is Wichita's CBS affiliate, they instead decided to issue their own warnings on the storm based on radar and spotter information, rather than restart the system, because this was a lengthy task of around 10 minutes. And it was taking place during a critical weather emergency. The decision on their part to not restart the system would likely save many lives in the path of this storm. On Thursday the 25th, the National Severe Storms Forecast Center, which is the precursor to today's Storm Prediction Center, would issue a high-risk outlook for the following day for large parts of Kansas and Oklahoma, as well as parts of Nebraska, Missouri, and Arkansas. Shortly after midnight on the 26th, storms produced tornadoes in Iowa and Texas. By 11:38 a.m., a tornado watch is issued citing a particularly dangerous situation with the possibility of very damaging tornadoes. At around 4:30 p.m., a severe thunderstorm warning is issued for Harper County, Kansas, on the supercell thunderstorm that would go on to spawn at least four tornadoes that day, including the Hayesville Andover tornado. Not quite 20 minutes later, KAKE, or Cake TV, Wichita's ABC affiliate, receives word that the storm is producing 65-mile-per-hour winds and golf-ball-sized hail. At 5:15, the storm produces its first tornado, which travels on the ground for about a mile and will go on to be rated an F0. After it damages a roof outside Anthony, Kansas, roughly 60 miles southwest of Andover, it lifts. At 5:30, the storm produces its second tornado near Freeport, a hamlet east of Anthony a few miles. This tornado would be on the ground for 16 miles over rural areas before lifting just south of Argonia. It would later be rated an F0. Gosh, guys, I'm so sorry. So hard to get out of the habit of saying EF. This one didn't make the timeline, I know, and it probably should have because, you know, 16 miles is a long way to travel. But, you know, I kind of got some conflicting info when I was researching it, and some of my sources were classifying it as its own thing, and some sources were classifying it as part of this other storm. And I didn't really realize until I kind of got down into it that it was part of the same storm, according to the National Weather Service, whose information I'm going by. Yes, I know, not in the timeline, dishonor on me, dishonor on my cow. I'm including it here because, you know, this is one of the tornadoes that the National Weather Service does list as being part of the supercell that impacted Hayesville and Andover. So at this point, at Argonia, the storm is roughly 45 miles from Andover, and at this point, it's only building steam. At 5:49 p.m., the supercell cycles a third time, producing a tornado east of Clearwater, which is south of Wichita and southwest of Andover by about 25 miles. This tornado would grow into the F5 monster that would claim 17 lives. It would travel relatively unimpeded over rural areas north and east until about 6:20. At this point, reports of the funnel are coming fast and furious as Derby police, which Derby is east of Hayesville, Derby police are confirming this tornado as it comes into Hayesville, which is a suburb of Wichita. It enters the city as a very strong F2. It damages homes and businesses with, thankfully, no fatalities. Storm chaser John Davies films the tornado from the East 47th Street South overpass as it obliterates a greenhouse of flowers. I think at Cox Farms, if I remember right, which turns the funnel pink. And I'm going to link to that video because it's just astounding. It just wipes out this greenhouse. I think of geraniums, and the whole funnel turns pink. He also captures the tornado as it crosses I-35 and sets its sights on McConnell Air Force Base. It rips through the south end of Boeing's Wichita plant, damaging part of the facility, before cutting a path across McConnell Air Force Base, 12 miles from Andover, as an F3. At 6:24, Sergeant Todd Kravitz captures one of the most iconic videos of the tornado from a base dormitory. I'll link his video in the show notes with a similar video that documents the immediate aftermath on base. But in Sergeant Kravitz's video, you can see the funnel as it writhes closer and closer to the viewer. And in the background, you can hear the sirens on base, and they're just wailing, and then they rise to this crescendo and die off completely to silence. Debris is lofted and circulates wildly, blasting through a parking lot until the video cuts back to the tornado moving away. You can see people ducking for cover, yet still popping out of what appears to be a stairwell, almost in disbelief. It would take a direct aim on the base's hospital, where patients in the ER had little warning, and the legal office, destroying both. 109 housing units and 9 major facilities, including the gym and child care center, would be damaged or destroyed. Miraculously, it would miss a flight line of brand new B-1B bombers by less than 1,000 feet, two of which were armed with nuclear warheads. That was something new that I learned that I did not remember from years past and researching this event prior to. So yeah, the tornado would leave the base at this point with injuries, but no fatalities. This would change as the storm moves into far southeast Wichita. Here's where my content warning kicks in, and you might want to skip ahead a couple of minutes. In this area, the tornado would take its first victims. Anna Marie and Susan Cravens, ages 5 and 2, are ripped from the arms of their aunt, Charlene Montgomery, as they fled for shelter. At their funeral, their mother, Kathy, reads a letter that no mother should have to write. In it, she remembers her beautiful girls. She offers this piece of advice. Treasure your loved ones. Tell them that you love them. And as a mom myself to a daughter that's 2, listening to her tell her girls goodbye is so very hard for the mom in me to listen to. Okay, the hard part for me is past. You can kind of come back if you were skipping the sensitive content. At 6:30, a tornado warning is issued for Butler County, extending from the warning in Sedgwick County, and includes the city of Andover. Here's where several things kind of happen in rapid succession. First, the tornado reaches F5 status at about the Butler-Sedgwick County line. Next, the siren system in Andover fails. According to meteorologist Mike Smith's retrospective for the 30th anniversary, Andover sirens never sounded due to the sheer number of reports. The volume of radio and phone traffic clogged the frequency used to set off the sirens. They literally confused the system to the point of overload. Lastly, realizing that there was no way to warn residents, law enforcement took to the streets driving and broadcasting the warning. Dashcam footage from Andover Police Department Sergeant Paul C's cruiser shows him driving through the Golden Spur Mobile Home Park between 6:30 and about 6:35, warning the residents to take cover. About 200 residents would ride out the storm in the park's public shelter. At 6:45 p.m., the F5 tornado, now about a half mile wide, begins to grind through the city. It's at this point a golfer at Terradyne Golf Course in northwest Andover, Duke Evans, grabs his camcorder and begins filming from the clubhouse looking southeast. I'll link this video also, but it's probably another of the most well-known videos of this tornado, and maybe of tornadoes in general. In it, you can see the funnel, you can see the green grass of the course, and the two contrast as the grass is so bright green, so highly saturated, and the funnel is just this inky purple darkness, and it churns behind these large houses on the edge of the golf course. Merrill Teller, who's the retired chief meteorologist for KWCH, recalls in his own interview for the 30th anniversary that the tornado is passing about a half to three quarters of a mile behind these homes. It doesn't soften the violence of the storm as the funnel hurls both debris and condensation sheets or scud clouds around itself. This video is a perfect example of how amateur photographers with their handheld camcorders helped make this event so impactful. For the first time in my memory, these events were brought into our homes where we experienced Mother Nature through the lens of others who were much like ourselves. And as Mr. Evans is filming, the tornado is ripping through the Golden Spur Mobile Home Park, claiming another 13 lives. At 7:10, the tornado finally dissipates west of El Dorado and north of the Kansas Turnpike after damaging the outskirts of Towanda, about 10 miles northeast of Andover. It would cycle again and produce another well-documented tornado along the turnpike, catching two reporters for KSNW off guard. Greg Jarrett and Ted Lewis were out on an unrelated story, and ended up becoming a story themselves. Their video would go on to incorrectly shape the public's perception of storm safety for years to come. In this video, the pair flee down the interstate as Ted Lewis films. And you can kind of hear them discuss whether or not they need to speed up. I think Greg Jarrett asks if he needs to go faster. And Ted Lewis says no at first. And then immediately backpedals and he says, yeah, we need to go faster. We need to go lots faster. It's catching us. They are unable to outpace the tornado at highway speeds. So they pull over under an overpass to seek shelter. And they're there with several other vehicles. And Lewis advises everyone to get under the structure of the bridge, the girders, for cover. As everyone scrambles to get under the concrete and iron, Lewis would hold his camera down, pointed down the highway back the direction that they had come. And if you look carefully, you can see a van caught by the wind as it's rolled several times into the median. Now, I'm going to see if I can find a clip where they slow it down, because it does happen very, very quickly. And even if you're watching for it, you might miss it because it happens that fast. If I remember correctly, the driver in the vehicle was injured as the van tumbles across several lanes. You can hear the wind. You can see the grasses in the ditch and on the embankment just bend to the ground as the funnel passes, seemingly directly over the top of them. Everyone under the bridge would walk away with minor injuries. Their vehicles would lose windows and, you know, but they would walk away without injuries. Others caught on the road without shelter would not be so lucky. They would receive injuries, some serious, when their vehicles are rolled or tossed from the highway. This footage would go on to win an Emmy, but the simple truth is they got lucky. For starters, this tornado, an F2, actually didn't make a direct hit on the overpass itself. It passed instead kind of just east of the bridge. So the winds that they're getting aren't from the main part of the funnel. They're kind of getting the outer bands of rotation. And you know, the structure of that bridge may have also provided some protection. Not all overpasses are created equally. They don't all share the same architecture. And it's the National Weather Service just strongly advises against sheltering under overpasses of any kind. So although Jarrett and Lewis's video is compelling, it's far better to heed warnings in advance of the storm and try not to put yourself in this position at all. In the immediate aftermath, EMS units from surrounding counties geared up and headed into the area. They found only one road not blocked by debris. Jim Schmidt, who would go on to become Andover's first emergency manager, he was then part of a volunteer EMS service out of Rose Hill, and he can recall driving home and seeing the tornado. He and his wife would stop to watch it for several minutes before he's, you know, hey, I'm going to have to go. He reports to the Rose Hill Volunteer EMS station and is one of the first units to respond to Andover. At the time, Andover had a population of about 4,500, and they only had a single ambulance. This ambulance crew meets Rose Hill EMS and Schmidt at the intersection north of what had been the Golden Spur Mobile Home Park. They report hundreds of injuries. As victims begin to swarm out of the mobile home park, carrying victims on sheets of plywood or by hand bringing them to help, this intersection at Central and Andover would become triage. A charity golf tournament at Terradyne Golf Course, where Duke Evans shot his now famous video, brought about 30 doctors to Andover to help. Schmidt says he recalls seeing an ambulance from nearby Heston, Kansas, a town that had taken a hit from an F5 the previous spring, who had themselves received help from many of the same services responding to Andover. Of the 241 mobile homes at the Golden Spur Mobile Home Park, Washington Post contributor Edward Walsh would note in an April 28th article that only 20 had survived largely intact. Not unharmed, not habitable, simply mostly still in a single piece. One vehicle from this area would be thrown 3/4 of a mile and be found by surveyors who are unable to identify the severely mangled wreckage as car or pickup. 38 residents of the Golden Spur ride out the tornado unsheltered. 13 pay the ultimate price. Some that were unsheltered believed that they had more time to get to shelter than they did. Victims like Ruby Crawford, perhaps caught trying to reach her elderly neighbors, Robert and Gladys Manis, to get them to shelter. I've tried to find more information online about the victims to tell you who they were, Not much exists online, but I do plan a trip to the public library to see what I can find on microfilm from the Wichita Eagle. That will be for a later episode. For now, I will simply tell you what I do know. Charlene Montgomery and her nieces Anna Marie and Susan Cravens, ages 5 and 2, were killed in southeast Wichita near or in the Greenwich Heights area. Joseph Babbitt, Ruth Crawford, Ron Canavy Sr., Ron Canavy Jr., Elsie Kemper, Gladys and Robert Manis, Joseph Marks, Robert Manager, Denise Patterson, Betty Sanders, Kathy Sargent, and Bessie Temple at the Golden Spur Mobile Home Park in Andover, Matilda Bebo, and Derek Malone, about whom I could not determine, but still continue to look. In the days and weeks following, gas and electric services from across the state, the Midwest, and the South would send over 600 workers to respond, working from sunup and into the night to get infrastructure repaired and online. High school and college students from the area would arrive to help remove debris. The Red Cross, Catholic Charities, the Mennonite Church, and many other organizations would come and assist in many ways as well. Cleanup and rebuilding would take almost a year, as about 30% of the town of Andover was left homeless on the 26th. Today, Andover flourishes, with almost 14,000 residents. They haven't forgotten their darkest hour, and have come through stronger with a determination to protect residents from Mother Nature's fury, in whatever form it might find them next. Next up, I share about this day from my personal memories as I discuss the F4 Cali County tornado. I guess I should probably go ahead and, before I really get into this, all of the storms that I'm talking about today happened in Kansas. There were some other fairly significant tornadoes that happened in Oklahoma that day. One of those I am actually going to try and give its own episode to because it's kind of my current neck of the woods, but also because the tornado in Oklahoma that I want to talk about, the Red Rock tornado, also an F4, was studied, and there's some information that goes along with that. There's some information that goes along with the Red Rock tornado that I would like to cover in its own separate episode because it was very highly studied, and it's one of the storms that the Norman Doppler radar happened to be able to capture. What happened in Andover and Hayesville, all the stuff that happened in Kansas, that Doppler radar couldn't see it very well. And so we don't really have any Doppler information on the storms that happened in Kansas that day, simply because they were too far away for the radar to see. The Red Rock tornado also at one point, I believe, had the highest wind speed ever recorded on Earth. And so I kind of feel like it deserves its own episode. And as I go along with the show, I do intend to talk about it and to talk about some of the other storms that happened in Oklahoma on April 26th, but just know for the most part in this episode, well, all of the storms that I talk about in today's episode they take place in Kansas. I'm going to go ahead and get into the Cali County tornado just real quick. I don't have a lot on it, mostly because I was 4 when this happened. Most of my memories are flashbulb memories and what I remember hearing from adults. I do have memories of going out and looking at the damage afterward, and I'll talk about that a little bit. But we had some family friends come over and tell us, hey, the weather's going to be bad. Let's go to my mom's house. She has a cellar. You know, we just want to be close to somewhere to take cover just in case. And I remember kind of being excited because I was like, ooh, cellar. And I remember always wanting to play in my grandparents' cellar and always wanting to play in the cellar, and it just being this damp, dark. I just remember it being this damp, dark source of curiosity for me because I had never had to get in one for its intended purpose. I was always just nosy and wanted to see. So at about 5:30, I think, about 5:30 p.m., a funnel takes place and it starts stretching for the ground west of Cali, west of our Kansas City, about 5 miles. This is roughly the same time that Freeport, out between Anthony and Argonia, would be seeing their tornado. So right about the time the second tornado of the Andover storm is forming, Cali County is also seeing its tornado. It drops 5 miles west of our Kansas City, and it will continue on the ground for about 25, 26 miles. And it cuts through mostly rural areas. I mean, lots of fields, lots of... However, it clips a cemetery. It narrowly misses an elementary school outside of Winfield, Kansas, and goes on to take a direct hit on a mobile home outside of the village Tisdale, which is east of Winfield. Yeah, it's east of Winfield. But it does kill the occupant. They would come out and survey this storm, and they would rate the damage an F4. Of this storm, I can remember sitting at our friend's mom's house in the living room. I remember the adults kind of talking about something. I'm sure that we were probably watching the news. And it wasn't like it is now, where if there's bad weather, they cover it all the time. They don't have advertisement breaks. It is just weather all the time, which I appreciate. And I think that's the way it always should have been done, but you still had to have your advertisements and you still had to mention your sponsors back in 1991 because they were paying the bills. But what I remember the most is I remember the power flickered. And the most vivid part of that sticks with me is the house being just plunged into this almost total darkness the last time the electricity goes out. And in my mind's eye, it's really hard for me to tell if it's afternoon or night. And even in conversations with my mom over the last couple of weeks, trying to, you know, glean some other memories maybe, or see what she remembered, we both kind of were surprised to realize that tornado happened in the late afternoon. So, I mean, it should have been very sunny. And I do apologize. I'm trying to get this recording finished. If you can hear the thunder, it is actually storming here this morning as I am recording this. But I remember the lights go off that last time and being plunged into this almost complete darkness and just this pause. And you probably heard the phrase, a pregnant pause. Man, this was it, because you had 4 or 5 adults in this room with a little one sitting there, and they are waiting for someone, anyone, to say something. And finally, out of the darkness, I hear a voice say, "Well, I guess it's time to go." So we all stood up. My mom picked me up. And I kind of vaguely remember somebody had a flashlight or a lantern. I mean, we took a light source with us that was on when we were outside, not when we were in the cellar. I remember it being in use on the way to the cellar, which was not super far from the door. I'm so sorry, guys. I've had a conversation with Jim, the weather intern, about his studio etiquette, and frankly, he might just be hopeless. Anyway, I remember going and sitting in the basement in the cellar, and I don't really remember panic. I remember boredom. And I'm sure that we joked about stuff because, you know, what else are you going to do sitting in the dark in the cellar waiting to get hit by a tornado? But I know my mom has never particularly liked storms, which is probably why it was super easy to talk her into being over there and near that cellar, because she went through a tornado, I think in Midwest City in Oklahoma when she was a kid. And I just always remember that she had never particularly liked bad weather. So that's, I mean, I kind of vaguely remember coming out and there was no real damage where we were. But I think we were within about 3 miles of where that tornado touched down. And something else that I remembered about that day, my dad worked for Boeing at the Wichita facility. And I guess I shouldn't say I remember this, but it's something that we've discussed several times in the last few weeks. And due to time, we don't really have, we can't remember if Dad was at work that day or not. Which, I mean, to me, I'm sitting there thinking, you know, how can you not remember where you were at this, with this super significant weather event? And, you know, it was significant to me, but it was not significant to him, because my dad witnessed he witnessed the aftermath of the Blackwell, or the, goodness, there's so damn many tornadoes. My dad witnessed the aftermath of the Udall tornado of 1955, which pretty much wiped the city of Udall, the town of Udall, off the map. So, you know, maybe Andover was not as significant to him because he had seen different at a young age as well. So I think Udall will probably always stick with him as being a storm that he could tell you where he was and what he was doing. But I want to get into just a couple of quick things about that storm in Cali County. I have a friend that was telling me when I said, you know, I want to start this podcast and here's my idea and here's the first story I want to tell. She said, oh, good, because here's the story that I have. She lived on the other side of Arkansas City, probably a little bit further out than the house that we were at for the cellar. And she said that she and her son stood out in the backyard and they watched that tornado as it moved through. And I mean, it was well north of them. They were perfectly safe to do so. But she said, you know, it was just black as night and a mile wide. And she's not wrong. Going back and looking at the official statement from the National Weather Service and looking in a couple of different places, that tornado was actually pretty close to a mile wide. So it was not a little tornado, and who knows if it had gone through the more populated areas of Winfield or Ark City, who knows what the outcome might have been. Thankfully, we'll never know. In the days following the storm, I remember going out with my parents and looking at damage in the area. And one of the places that I remember going, there is a cemetery north of Ark City called Memorial Lawn. And they had a really pretty brick wall, like a half wall, and it had a design in it. It was really pretty, and when the tornado came through, it toppled about half of that wall. So I can remember seeing the bricks scattered all over the ground and being very kind of shocked, I guess. But as the tornado cut through, I think that it clipped the north part of that cemetery. As it continued north and east, it hit another smaller cemetery whose name I cannot remember and cannot find. But it also hit the tree row probably like a half to a quarter mile north of that. And to this day, if you drive through in the fall or in the winter after the leaves have fallen off the trees, you can still see where the trees are very twisted and they grow in not inorganic shapes, but they just don't grow in natural shapes. And you can see that scarring left over even now, 30 years after it happened. But I can remember driving through areas and seeing thin sheets of metal wrapped around fence posts and trees and telephone poles, and just the sheer amount of insulation, you know, that bright pink or yellow insulation caught in fences, caught in telephone lines. It, as a kid, you don't understand the power behind how that gets there. It's just this, not quite marvel, but I guess it's just very surprising because that's not where that stuff is supposed to be. So, you know, I guess the biggest thing for me is this taught me that I wanted to know more about the weather. I didn't want to be afraid of it. I wanted to have a healthy respect. And I just, I wanted to use my knowledge to not be so afraid of storms. And, you know, if I was having anxiety, I wanted it to be a productive anxiety, you know, being able to tell myself it's, you know, it's not time to panic yet. Here's what you know about. I guess the biggest takeaway for me, from the Cali County tornado, even though I was young, is it instilled a respect of Mother Nature. And I always remember hearing, you know, respect Mother Nature because she has no respect for you. I think that's going to wrap up today. I'm going to tag some social media stuff at the end of this episode, and I will have the show notes with some of the videos that I referenced. I'm also going to link to a couple of the articles that I talk about, and just a couple of articles that I didn't mention specifically, but that still have really good information. So, yeah, we'll catch you guys next time. Next time we are discussing Hurricane Ike, and I will be interviewing my friend Brittany about her experiences during that storm. Okay, we'll see you guys next time. Hey guys, thanks for listening to today's episode. If you're looking for more content from the podcast, you can check us out on Facebook and Twitter at Caught in the Fury. If you have a storm story to share, you can submit that either on Google Forms, and I will post the link to that as well, or you can email it to us. We now have email at caughtinthefury@gmail.com. We are available not only on Spotify and Anchor now, we are also on Google Podcasts, Breaker, Radio Public, and Pocket Casts at Caught in the Fury. So come back and see us.